Welcome to Blockstream Talk number 8. Our conversation today is with Jonas Nick, a core tech engineer on Blockstream's research team. Jonas is one of the authors of the recent Taproot protocol upgrade, so there's really nobody better to talk to about the benefits of Taproot and other innovations coming to Bitcoin in the future. Jonas is also very recently in El Salvador and has some interesting boots-on-the-ground observations on how El Salvador's Lightning Network rollout is going and what some challenges are that average users are bumping into. If you find this episode useful, don't forget to like and subscribe. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Great. Jonas, thanks for taking the time and joining us today.
Hey.
Maybe we can start off with a quick introduction, who you are and what you're working on.
So I'm Jonas. I work at the research group at Blockstream. And the research group kind of focuses on broadly two different things. One is signatures and one is script languages. And I'm more in the signatures department. So I work on open source implementations of various crypto things for Bitcoin Core and also elements and Liquid sidechain. I also do research on these things, write papers. I'm a co-author of the Music paper. I'm also a co-author of the Schnorr and Taproot BIP.
I saw your presentation in El Salvador, and maybe you can give us a quick kind of overview of what you see as the main innovations in Bitcoin right now.
I think there are a lot of innovations going on in Bitcoin right now, and I'm not in the position to give everyone a good understanding of what the main innovations are. I was focusing on the innovations that we're doing at Blockstream, and also I'm myself involved, because they are already enough to fill half an hour of talk easily. And what we're doing there, the things I mentioned are, for example, the Taproot upgrade, that we put a lot of work into that, because people may not know how these things emerge. You need to have a stage where you collect ideas, then you need to write it down, write a specification, how everything is supposed to work. And you need to make it so detailed that different implementations of this specification agree on what is actually a Schnorr signature or what is a Taproot output. So you have to be very careful with these things. And once you have the specification and you have feedback, you can, or in parallel, you have to implement it. Right. And that's enough. And then you have to check, does it actually match the specification? Are there corner cases that you haven't thought of, or many other? Can people actually use it? Is it hard to use? Is it easy to use? Is it easy to misuse, especially in a cryptography context? That is a very important aspect, that you don't want people to accidentally misuse a certain kind of function and end up, let's say, exposing their secret signing key and losing their coins. So that would be very bad. So Taproot is one of the things that I mentioned during my talk, because what Taproot gives us in a nutshell is indistinguishability of various Bitcoin coins. And I think this is a very key aspect in how Bitcoin is supposed to work, because what you want is that all Bitcoin look the same. They are indistinguishable from each other. You don't know if there's a certain smart contract running behind it, if this is part of a Lightning channel or anything like that. And with you, I mean, a blockchain observer shouldn't see that. And with Taproot, we can get towards this direction where outputs or Bitcoins in general are indistinguishable.
So how long does that process typically take? Like when you have an idea to implement something and then to be reviewed and kind of troubleshooted and then eventually deployed, how long does that take?
I would say that depends on what you're proposing. For example, Taproot is special because it's a soft fork. And in recent years, we haven't had many of those. Like the last one was SegWit, and that feels like a very long time ago.
It does. Feels like several lifetimes ago.
Yeah. So Taproot, the central idea of Taproot was proposed, I think, early 2018, and Taproot was activated in November 2021. So yeah, it took a while. we got relatively lucky with activation, because that is another very important aspect that I didn't mention. When you have the implementation, even before doing the implementation, you should know that there's actually community consensus that people actually want this, because only then can you ever propose something to be included into the Bitcoin protocol. And luckily for Taproot, this is also why it was so appealing to us. Taproot is something that people can get behind. There aren't that many trade-offs that you have to do. It is basically a net or an easy to see net positive. And this is why we got community buy-in relatively quickly. And this is also why it's activated quickly through this speedy trial method.
Yeah, so I saw one of the slides that you had. I'm not sure if it was from the El Salvador presentation or another one that I watched, but you had a slide that kind of highlighted Bitcoin's core principles. So what do you see as Bitcoin's core principles, and how do you think Taproot kind of improves those principles?
The core principle of Bitcoin is resilience against actors that try to overtake it or try to gain power in the system. What you want, and how do you achieve that? You achieve that by having decentralized full nodes that verify the Bitcoin chain, that are able to verify the Bitcoin chain and to check that there are no coins created out of thin air, and that the ledger is consistent, and that they can make transactions that aren't going to be censored. The system must be censorship resistant. If you see this as the core principle, then you see why we are taking a certain directions in Bitcoin development over others. For example, if you go to a I could tell a little story. We were at a financial cryptography conference, and we gave a presentation about Taproot, and then one influential cryptographer asked us, why are you caring about these details? Taproot is a detail for them. Why don't you fix proof of work? Why don't you research proof of stake? That would be have a much higher impact in their perspective, because they don't understand that the key principle of Bitcoin is resilience, and we have to engineer around that. Now, what does around that mean? Well, what we want is, for example, that people can actually make transactions, right? We don't want that transactions become, or perhaps transactions is the wrong word, I would rather say payments, that payments are too expensive to do on Bitcoin. We want that Bitcoin is private. Otherwise, it can't be resilient, because if it is private, then, for example, you can't attack a real world identity if you know the Bitcoin address, let's say. So these are the things that we need to take into account: scalability, privacy, and keeping Bitcoin resilient. And one of these things, how to achieve this, is this Taproot update, because it makes Bitcoin indistinguishable, which improves privacy and also improves scalability.
Yeah. Okay. So we got some questions on Twitter about Taproot. And one of the questions was, what off-chain capabilities would you want to see deployed before you consider Taproot to have achieved its full potential?
So I think there are a lot of things that you could also do with Taproot, and a lot of things people are experimenting with right now. We don't know what people come up with in the future. One thing that we can do really well is also, that I also mentioned in the presentation with Taproot now, that was hard to do before, is this concept of key aggregation. Okay, so one of the things where this really matters is in the Liquid sidechain, right? So what the Liquid sidechain is, it's a federation of multiple entities that sign Bitcoin transactions. Right now, that's an 11 of 15 federation. So you need 11 out of 15 signers before a transaction becomes valid. And what they are doing, they are basically processing the withdrawal from the sidechain. So if you say on the sidechain, you want your sidechain Bitcoin sent to this Bitcoin address on the main chain, the functionaries are responsible to create this Bitcoin transaction. Okay. So right now what happens is that in order to make this transaction, these functionaries have to write 11 signatures into the Bitcoin chain. Now, 11 signatures is not only a waste of space, a waste of blockchain space, but it's also very expensive to do. With this concept of key aggregation that now becomes easier in Taproot, we can compress all those keys into a single key. Like, we have this 11 of 15 policy, we can compress it and express it in a single key, which means that it also only requires a single signature to make this transaction. So in the sidechain case, in the liquid sidechain case, that doesn't help with privacy, but it helps with scalability, and it makes things that were perhaps previously uneconomical, federated sidechains, more economical because you have to spend much less on fees. Similarly, back to this topic. So this in general is called a threshold signature. So what you want there, express a policy, M of N policy in a single public key and a single signature. That's something that we are in the research team working on. Then you have something like green address, right? Green address, you want to have good privacy, but in the green Blockstream green wallet, you have this multisig, right? And you have this other spending condition, which allows you to spend a coin after a while in case the Blockstream server gets offline or for a longer period of time, right? So again, Blockstream Green is a 2 of 2 multisig, and you yourself can get your coins back after a while if there's something wrong with the Green server. And this allows you to have two-factor authentication. It's a cool idea. But having this 2 of 2 multisig plus this condition, this extra condition, makes your coin distinguishable on chain. And that's something that you absolutely want to avoid. So what Green should do and will do, perhaps in 2022, is to use Taproot to make green Blockstream green transactions indistinguishable from normal transactions. And this now not only has a scalability benefit because fewer things end up on the chain, but it also has this privacy component, which is really important for end users. And finally, there are a lot of upgrades in proposed for Lightning, for example, such as including music key aggregation into Lightning and PTLCs, etc. So I think that's still a lot of work to get there, but at least the first part, which would be use key aggregation in for Lightning channels, which means that you open a channel and it looks like an ordinary transaction, and closing a channel looks like an ordinary transaction. I think these things we can get earlier, but that is certainly something that will really show Taproot's capabilities.
So helping to improve privacy, not just on Bitcoin, but also within the Lightning Network as well.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned scaling, and you know, I think one thing that's interesting of Bitcoin is that as it grows, and this is the way mass adoption pulls out, is that every cycle you get new people in. And I think that's good. But one of the problems with that is often people that come in, there's a lot of context that's missing from the previous cycles. And I think the history of Bitcoin is really interesting. You know, the scaling war of 2016, 2017, and the BCH hard fork, I think that was probably the biggest existential threat to Bitcoin to date, in my opinion. Do you agree with that? And can you give us a quick run through of that debate and why eventually the small block position was shown to be kind of the most compelling?
I am not sure if that was the biggest war in the Bitcoin space so far. It was one of the bigger ones, but I mean, in the early Bitcoin days, the community was much smaller, so it was less loud than maybe it was in 2017, but still a lot of decisions were made that put Bitcoin on the path that is right now, and that was also relevant then in 2017. So I also mentioned this during my talk in El Salvador. If you look,
I know that's why I'm asking.
if you look at how do you onboard the whole world into Bitcoin on Bitcoin from today to tomorrow, right? In a day, that wouldn't work because there's just not the capacity to do this because blocks are restricted in size. So the obvious idea would be, well, then just increase the block size. And this seems to be appealing. It wouldn't get the whole world on Bitcoin, but perhaps some improvement might get El Salvador onto Bitcoin. I'm just talking about layer one right now, because that was the discussion in 2017. And the problem with this, of course, is that it increases the cost to verify the Bitcoin blockchain. But as I said earlier, this is the key property of Bitcoin. If we are not able to verify the Bitcoin blockchain, and Bitcoin is not resilient as a result of that, then why are we doing this in the first place? It doesn't make sense. Bitcoin needs to be resilient. Hence, we cannot easily increase the block size. I'm not against increasing the block size forever, but there needs to be a process perhaps that leads towards that, and that also needs to be thought through under these considerations of resilience. And also, I think that is, I think, one of the key properties, key aspects why the small blocker narrative won. And the other one is also, we're seeing more and more how layered scaling works. And for that, you don't necessarily need huge blocks, right? You can make a lot with small blocks by having layers on top, such as Lightning or Liquid.
Yeah, I think we discussed this with Christian as well. Like, it seems like the approach to scaling now is to do as much off-chain as possible before having settle on Bitcoin. So you've got layer two, like Lightning and Liquid, and then better batching practices from the exchanges. So there's a lot of things that can go on to improve that, I guess, before you need to, like you mentioned, eventually increase the block size at some point.
You shouldn't say you, because the community is in charge. I'm certainly not in charge. So
I mean the general you, yeah. So that's interesting what you said about it not being the biggest threat to Bitcoin, because 2016 and 2017 for myself, I mean, I found that quite confusing, and you weren't quite sure. I mean, a lot of the things, it was just an interesting time, right? Like, because it was much smaller. You had people like Bitmain and, you know, Roger Ver were huge personalities within the industry. And, you know, and then you had, you know, the Craig Wright and those kind of guys making really bombastic claims that was kind of like muddying the waters and difficult to figure out what was going on. And it felt like it could go either way, right? So what did you mean when you thought that there was things before that may have been bigger threats?
So I read the Block Size War book by Jonathan Beer. It's a really great book. I can recommend it. And, according to that book, I am an extremist small blocker at the time who always thought that the big block movement would never succeed. There's no chance that they would succeed. So that was my view at the time, because if they fork, no one would be interested. In the long run, the small block narrative must win, because it's the only one that can be resilient, and the other one will not be decentralized and will be taken over eventually. I guess it's just a difference how long your time horizon is. But I think in the early days, there were a lot of discussions. I mean, if you just think about how should Bitcoin core governance work? Should there be a benevolent dictator that dictates how everything should work? And
how much support did that idea get? That sounds like not a very popular idea.
It got a lot of support. There's a proven model where it works, and that's the Linux kernel, and that's the biggest open source project and the most successful probably ever. And they have a benevolent dictator, and it works well. It just doesn't work for Bitcoin.
So shifting gears to El Salvador, you were there recently. What's your impression from being kind of there, boots on the ground, of what's going on with El Salvador and the Lightning Network?
So this was a fascinating trip, I have to say.
Yeah, I bet.
To be honest, it felt like kind of being in the center of the world for a moment. So I had to recover from that. I mean, this was in November, so I have recovered since then. But it was really weird just to go back to a country where you couldn't pay with Bitcoin anymore if you wanted. So that was just a really weird thing. Of course, there are a lot of problems in El Salvador right now with Bitcoin. This is a huge experiment. The biggest problem is simply the the government wallet, the Chivo app, because it was rushed. I mean, it was implemented in 3 months or whatever. And first of all, it doesn't show transactions on the receiving end, which is a problem. If you are at a market with a merchant and your app shows that you've sent the coins, and it's probably true because in Lightning you have the proof of payment, for example. In Bitcoin, you see it on the blockchain. And in their app, it doesn't show up. Now, what now, right? That's a big problem. Now you can give them cash as well, but that's not great either. And these things, they happen, like, I would say, with 20% or 30% probability. So it's not great. And if you experience that a few times, yeah, you think, should I really go through the hassle and ask about paying with Bitcoin? So that's one problem. The other problem is that just this app is not designed for a user. From the UI perspective, it's terrible. So just to find the screen where you would get a Lightning invoice, you have to click 5 times. And if you are a Bitcoiner in El Salvador, you have to learn how Chivo works, not because you want to use it as a sender, but because you want to show the merchants how they can give you a Lightning invoice. I think these things, they're probably just a matter of time. Like, they need to improve. They probably will. So that's one aspect. Of course, most El Salvadorians outside of the Bitcoin beach, they immediately exchange the received Bitcoin into US dollars on the Chivo app, because in the end, they want US dollars for stability.
So my understanding was most of the transactions were actually done with US dollars and Bitcoin was just kind of in the background facilitating the payment. Is that correct? Like, if you're buying, you know, whatever, a bottle of water and, you know, price action today in Bitcoin was kind of, we could have possibly been a bit of a problem. So is that how it's done?
They open the app and then they enter the price in US dollars, and then they do this 5 clicks to find the little buttons that give you a Lightning invoice, and then you pay that. So you pay a Lightning invoice, but they immediately exchange it internally to the US dollar.
So what do people think of Bitcoin in El Salvador? Just like vendors, taxi drivers, people like that. Are they supportive of Bitcoin, or they just find it to be a massive pain in the ass?
Generally, they don't have a lot of contact with Bitcoin. They have this Chivo app. They probably downloaded it because it has this free 30 US dollars once you downloaded it.
Yeah.
And then they sometimes use it between Chivo wallets. And these transactions, they are just database entries and they are just US dollars. So people generally, they don't have a really good understanding what Bitcoin is. Even the basics, like Bitcoin doesn't have a central bank, or Bitcoin is decentralized censorship money. People on the street, they don't know that yet, but they have this app. And they have tourists coming there wanting to pay with Bitcoin. And you see where this can go with Bitcoin Beach, where this is like really a different kind of area, because there it's very easy to pay with Bitcoin because everyone understands it and people also want to receive Bitcoin.
It sounds like the issues are probably more from the wallet than from Bitcoin and the Lightning Network itself, right? So at Bitcoin Beach, I guess you use whatever wallet you want and then things just work as normal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Lightning Network works, Bitcoin works. The wallet there is a problem, but I guess that can be improved. But also, I guess the education side is also another thing. Like, people need to understand how to actually use this digital wallet such that these Bitcoin tourists can use it in the first stage, and then later they might want to actually save in Bitcoin, for example. But they're not there yet. And as you say, with the current price action, I think it will take a while before people get this idea that in the long run, Bitcoin goes up.
Yeah. So did you get any interesting feedback from the trip? Like, did you learn anything unexpected from seeing the Bitcoin and the Lightning Network kind of being deployed in the wild at scale, like talking to people there? Did anything surprise you?
What surprised me, I guess, is just that it's can be so much fun to go around and ask to pay with Bitcoin. I have to say, not everyone has the Chivo app, right? You can, I mean, if you go to a random, let's say, small market from a developing country, I've asked many people there if they accept Bitcoin. And there, the ratio was perhaps 50-60%. If you go to actual shops in San Salvador, let's say in the mall, you go to pharmacy, coffee shop, there the probability was a little bit lower. But then sometimes you go to restaurants, there the probability is pretty high that they have already have this this Chivo app somewhere that they can use on as their point of sale system. So, but just going around asking to pay with Bitcoin and then being satisfied when it actually works, that was really a surprise. And then once that is taken away from you, when you go back, that it's it really feels like a loss.
Well, you need to move to El Salvador. That's the solution, right?
Yeah, I mean, as a tourist, it is generally annoying to exchange to the local currency, right? It's also expensive. So
yeah, exactly right.
Just from that perspective alone, it's much more convenient as a tourist to use Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's very cool. So another question that we got up on Twitter is, and I picked this one because I have no idea what they're asking about. They said, can you help with implementing PTLCs into Lightning on a day-to-day basis? And I'm not quite sure if that's a job offer. If it is, I'd be happy to introduce you. But what are PTLCs? Why do we want this? And why is having it on a day-to-day basis kind of significant or important?
Yeah, I saw this this question earlier. It's from René Picard, who's a Lightning dev. And so first, PTLC is this update, a proposed potential update for Lightning that would allow several things. One is that it makes Lightning payments more private than a few technical things. And you can do a lot of tricks with it that haven't yet explored sufficiently because we don't have the PTLC yet. So you can have some smart contract policies, think DLCs or whatever, inside Lightning.
So first of all, what does PTLC stand for? What does that mean?
Oh, PTLC is point time locked contracts. So right now, in perhaps you've heard in the Lightning Network, you use hash time locked contracts to forward a payment and make the payment on the route atomic. And you can do the same thing instead of using hashes, hash time lock contracts, HTLCs, you can do this with points, point time lock contracts then. Okay, and there's right now in the Lightning dev world, there's discussions on how to exactly build these things, etc. It's definitely part of the things that people want to see in Lightning. You could say it's on the roadmap, although there's no official roadmap.
So why do we want that? What's the benefit of it?
Yeah, one is the privacy aspect that I mentioned. Okay. So it's better privacy, and also you can do these DLC tricks, and you can get proof of payments, etc. So that's something that is that people are interested in having these point time lock contracts. I could go more into detail what the privacy problem is, for example, if you're interested.
Sure. Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so perhaps generally I said the hash time lock contracts, HLCs, they are used to make the payment atomic in the Lightning Network. Because in the Lightning Network, it's a network because you make a payment across over multiple hops, right?
Yep.
Now, the problem with HTLC is that every hop sees the same hash. So if you're doing a payment, the first hop on this payment and the last hop know that they are on the same route. And they can, since they're the first and the last, they know who is sending and where they're sending it to. And this is something that the Lightning Network was designed to avoid, because the Lightning Network uses onion encryption, etc. We have these hops exactly because we want better privacy. Now, with PTLCs, you can achieve that instead of having the hashes all be the same on the route, you have points, and these points can all be different or randomized, essentially. So people cannot correlate that they're on the same path, but it still works out in the sense that Lightning Protocol works and it's atomic.
Okay. That makes sense. That sounds important. You should help them.
Right. Before BTLCs, there are other things on the roadmap. For example, implementing music. And this, in if you open a Lightning channel right now, the Bitcoin that you're creating is essentially a two of two output, right? A two of two. You have two parties in a channel. You have a two of two output. And right now, what you're doing is to write both public keys and both signatures in the chain, and a blockchain observer will see this is a Lightning channel opening with high probability. Now, if you would use music, key aggregation, Taproot, then you could make it so that the two of two is aggregated into a single public key. It still expresses this two of two logic, but it's now a single public key and a single signature. And this makes opening and closing Lightning channels cheaper. And also, if you're using unannounced channels, more private. And I think this cheaper aspect is really important in the long run, because as we said, we only have so much space on the main chain. We need to move to different layers. And how do you move to a different layer? You need to make at least one on-chain transaction. So that transaction should be cheap. So that's music. And that is already my day job. So my already my day job is working on the Lightning roadmap. So no worries, René. I'm already working on it, and I will also work on PTLC.
All right. Apologies, René. I did try my best. So for the last question, I usually ask people, like, looking forward, what makes them most excited about Bitcoin in the future? But I think just, you know, we're recording this early January. So I think it makes sense to try and get some predictions out of you. That's kind of fun. So do you have any predictions for Bitcoin, Lightning Network, Taproot for 2022 that you'd like to share?
Predictions. I don't have predictions, but I have a lot of things that I will carefully observe. One is what do people actually do with Taproot? So that is really interesting to me. I think a lot of things can be improved that really have a user benefit. If I can choose between two wallets and one is more private and has cheaper fees, then I would obviously choose that one. So we need to get to that stage. Right now, Taproot outputs compared to other outputs, it's negligibly low. So
that takes time, right? I mean, how long did SegWit take to get to like a critical threshold? I mean, that took forever.
It definitely took forever. I don't know the exact numbers. It just takes time. But if you have an update that's clearly better, then you would hope that the incentives are so that people actually move to this new system. And there are already wallet developers who really move ahead, and they really quickly started implementing all those features. And some of them are already running in production, which is really cool. But it's just not the volume is just not there yet. So I guess that is something that is very interesting to see over the year. And then also how far, I mentioned earlier this idea of threshold signatures for Liquid, for example. How far do we get with that this year? So this is something that I think that makes a huge difference. Right now, what we are working on is music, and music is only allowing N of N. Like it allows doing a two of two Lightning output, for example, with key aggregation, so you only have one public key. How do you do that if you have 11 of 15? We know in theory how to do it. We need to implement it and we need to specify it. And that's going to be really interesting how far we get this year with that. And on the research side, I mean, there are so many things that I'm really excited about 2022. I'm not sure if I can list them all. Another thing that I'm really interested in personally is this whole story of signature aggregation. That's different to key aggregation. Signature aggregation helps you if you have a transaction, usually has multiple inputs, right? And for every input, you have at least one signature, right? If you spend a coin, you need a signature. So if you spend multiple coins, you need multiple signatures. The idea behind signature aggregation is to aggregate all those signatures into a single signature for a transaction. So you would have only one signature per transaction. And since signatures are relatively large compared to the rest of the transaction. This would have really a really nice benefit in terms of transaction size. Doesn't help with privacy or anything, but in terms of scalability, it's a really nice trick. And that's something that we're working in the research team, for example, because we still need to write a security proof for this. I mean, there, as in the Bitcoin world, there are always these ad hoc schemes that someone comes up with that seem to be secure. No one can break it. But Bitcoin in 2022, we want to have the best security proofs, etc., that we can get, because that is also a part of Bitcoin's resilience.
Yeah, I guess the first principle is kind of like a doctor, right? Like the Hippocratic oath, like you do no harm. You don't want to make it any worse than...
Right. And Bitcoin in general is resilient, relatively resilient. So we don't make it worse. We don't want to make it worse at all. If anything, we want to make it better. And Bitcoin, from this resiliency standpoint, works right now. So why would we change it? If we change it, then it really, I think, needs to have a tangible benefit.
Yeah, and exactly right. And that's exactly why it's such a unique asset, is the decentralization, the censorship resistance, the resiliency. Those are the things that make it unique and interesting. And I think, you know, that's why you want to preserve those things, because there's so many other assets, whether digital or traditional, that don't have those characteristics.
Right. Perhaps another prediction. I won't make a real prediction, but I'm saying that adoption is going up this year, certainly. I mean, I can't, general Bitcoin adoption, perhaps the price with it as well. But I shouldn't say this, but I have been in Bitcoin for a while, and Bitcoin has never felt as de-risked as it is right now. So it's just, compared to other assets, right? It's just a no-brainer. So yeah. I don't want to make a price prediction. I don't understand why Bitcoin is falling, but that's good for now. More cheap sats. Get a better distribution even of Bitcoin. That's why these dips are especially helpful. So see no problem with that.
That's great. All right, maybe that's a good note to wrap it up on. Thanks a lot for your time today, and I look forward to doing a follow-up at some point. Great.
Cool.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It was fun.
Bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Blockstream Talk. If you want to support the show, feel free to leave a review, like, subscribe, and share. It really helps us get on the right side of the social media algos. And follow us at Blockstream Talk on Twitter. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.